Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 10th day of August, 2023. I'm your host, Mark Call, and I've got an in-depth report that I want to do in the latter part of this newscast, but we'll begin with some stories from around the world to set it up, starting with World War III, where a Daily Mail headline says, "War has arrived on Putin's doorstep. Huge explosion tears through Russian defense plant near Moscow as drone attacks continue to target their capital. This blast tore through the Zagorsk optical mechanical plant in Sergeyev Posad, 46 miles northeast of Moscow, and a plant which makes optical devices for the military. And this came only hours after Moscow became the target of yet another drone attack, with Russia saying it has shot down two Ukrainian UAVs near the capital in the latest of a series of attacks on and around Moscow over recent months." Here's one from the Better Late Than Never files. It's been a long time coming, but Dr. Rand Paul is finally getting around to it. He's recommending the top prosecutor in Washington, D.C. pursue an investigation and criminal charges. They say possible criminal charges, but if there was a real investigation, they'd be a lead pipe cinch against Tony Fauci for allegedly, yeah, sure, lying under oath about the COVID-19 lab origins. Paul sent a letter to D.C. U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves on Tuesday demanding an investigation into the American Dr. Mengele for committing perjury during congressional hearings in 2021 when he claimed, and he knew better, that COVID did not come from a Chinese lab. He said that Fauci, quote, testified that the NIH has not ever and does not now fund gain-of-function research in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And, said Paul, in a subsequent hearing, "I warned Dr. Fauci of the criminal implications of lying to Congress and offered him an opportunity to recant his previous statements," said Senator Paul. And in response, Fauci claimed he, quote, never lied before Congress and did not retract the statement. Okay, what else is new? Except for the fact that real criminals are still getting away with it. Oh, yeah, unless you doubt that, the Daily Mail coverage adds, this move comes just weeks after Paul submitted an official criminal referral to the Department of Just Us, and an aide confirmed to the Daily Mail that the DOJ, I hope you're sitting down, folks, has never responded. More criminals getting away with it. Another no-brainer, no surprise. The Epoch Times reports that court records from Hunter Biden's imperiled bogus plea deal with the Department of Just Us. Yeah, they wanted to slap him on the wrist, and even that was too much for them. But now this one divulges details on more than $2.6 million that the alleged first son received from Communist China and various affiliates of the CCP, or Communist Chinese Party. Earlier, the DOJ announced their insultingly ridiculous plea agreement with the Biden-Fuhrer son, whereby he would plead guilty to two petty misdemeanor tax crimes and would have a felony gun charge diverted because, you know, the slave masters don't have to worry about the same kind of things that the slaves do. During a July 26th hearing on his plea deal with the Department of Just Us, Biden admitted to having received money from Communist Chinese energy firm CEFC, and the plea agreement demonstrates how in-depth prosecutors went with transactions between the whoring crackhead Biden heir, Chinese companies, and various CCP affiliates, totaling at least $2.6 million in bribes overall. However, says the story, the total is likely substantially higher due to the combined way that some of his income was listed in the document. More chicanery, criminality, and of course outright treason. This comes from Mark Pellin via Headline USA and also Zero Hedge. The discovery last month of that Chinese COVID biolab in California may have shocked the nation, but it probably didn't come as any surprise to Gruesome Newsom, the Communist Chinese Party surrogate governor, who also goes by the name Gavin, because he helped fund it. The now-notorious secret facility, says the piece, which contained a massive stockpile of various infective agents, including coronavirus, nearly 1,000 dead lab mice, and vials of unidentified biological fluids, also likely came as no surprise to the Biden regime. Why? Well, the FDA last year issued a recall warning for nearly 54,000 COVID rapid tests manufactured by the company that owned that lab. And would you believe they got a whole bunch of tax credits, both state and federal, to boot? I do like this quote, courtesy of Representative Mark Green of Tennessee, who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee. Quote, "Allowing a Chinese company to practice gain-of-function research on our shores is like inviting biological warfare into our backyard." Unquote. And hey, let's not kid ourselves, folks. That's exactly what's been going on. And let's turn next to the economic war on the once free American people. First, courtesy of Zero Hedge and Scott Shepard via RealClearMarkets.com, JP Morgan Chase is up to its old tricks, including debanking. Once again, it's not providing any explanations, though, and once again, it's targeting people who dare to question the far-left government/woke business conspiracy. Some of us call it a public-private partnership against liberty. In this case, it appears that Chase debanked, without warning, Drs. Syed Haider and, you know this name, Dr. Joseph Mercola. Wait, no, not just them, but also Dr. Mercola's employees and their families. All without explanation and, of course, not without context. You may recall that last fall, Chase debanked Senator, Ambassador, and Governor Sam Brownback's religious liberty organization after having debanked General Flynn and a whole bunch of other conservatives. Chase got called on the Brownback debanking. Then first they stonewalled, then later they lied half a dozen times about the reasons for the debanking. Then they went back to stonewalling. And why? Well, you know the answer. Because he dared to tell the truth about the, let's be real here, the Zyklon B not vaccine, and published over 600 articles on two Facebook casting doubt on the not vaccines, calling them, among other things, a medical fraud. But the American banksters aren't alone. Coutts Bank of Britain recently debanked the well-known influential conservative Nigel Farage, who championed Brexit. Which leads me to this story, courtesy of Moody's and also Hal Turner's radio show. Late Tuesday night, in the wee hours of the morning, Moody's Investor Service lowered the credit ratings for 10 small and mid-sized U.S. banks and said they may downgrade a whole bunch of other major lenders as well, including U.S. Bank Corp, Bank of New York Mellon, State Street Corporation, and Truist Financial Corporation, because of higher funding costs, potentially regulatory capital weaknesses, and rising risk tied to commercial real estate loans amid weakening demand for office space. That market, folks, is literally imploding. Oh, yeah, and they have a negative outlook for a whole bunch of other lenders as well. Bottom line, if you know the currency is going to collapse, why would you want to be out there on a limb with a bunch of banksters? I want to spend a few minutes today on a story of major importance that should be getting a lot more truthful attention than it's actually getting from a dishonest media that's trying to spin it into something entirely, not only unconstitutional, but absolutely antithetical to everything this nation once stood for. And by that I mean the rule of law. I'm going to take a particular blowtorch to a piece from the Daily Mail, but it's arguably not as bad as some of the spin you might see from places like the criminally negligent networks, including the WAPO, New York Times, MSNBC, et al. Essentially, anybody that uses the term fake electors or anything else that implies that there's anything other than not only an issue of real fraud here, and by that I'm referring to the 2020 so-called election, but a vital issue of law as well, i.e. the constitutional issues surrounding it, and what really should be called what it is, a constitutional crisis. Because you know what, folks? If we don't get one of those, we haven't got a constitution. And by the way, as of right now, I hope this is clear, we don't. Let me start then with this piece from the Daily Mail. The headline says, Trump's lawyers' secret memo details, and they put it in quotes, bold, controversial strategy. Now, listen to the propaganda that begins this piece. A plot, and how's that for a word that implies some kind of chicanery to overturn their revolution? By those who completed a successful coup, yeah, a plot, they say, to overturn what they think they successfully got away with. With the help of, and they put this in quotes at least, but it's still a disgusting term, fake electors, was spelled out in a memo obtained by the New York Times on Tuesday, with the document revealing, oh wow, what an amazing revelation, a key pillar of Jack Smith's, and I'm going to put one word in here because they're doing it, I might as well, propaganda, bogus. Well, that's two words. Indictment of Donald Trump. The memo was sent December 6, 2020, by a lawyer allied with Trump, Kenneth Cheesebro, to another lawyer working for the then-president, James Troupas. And it was one of at least three memos, the piece continues, which Cheesebro sent to the Trump team, sketching out a legal rationale, which is true so far now, for overturning the Biden victory, which is not true, when the votes were certified, bogus as that might have been, on January 6, 2021. Do you see how anybody can play at this game of inserting words in there to spin it either toward or away from the truth? We're seeing another example of the fact that the victors write the history, whether it was by hook or crook or force of arms. The fake electors' strategy, continues the propaganda, is one of the key accusations made in the August 1 indictment of Trump on charges of trying to overturn the election. You could obviously just as easily say trying to reveal the fake and restore integrity to an election. Cheesebro's not named in the indictment, the piece says, and is not currently facing charges, and I can't help but think there's a reason for that, folks. It should become clear as I go through this. But he is still referenced as co-conspirator number 5. He's described in the indictment as an attorney who assisted in devising and attempting to implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential elections, sick, to obstruct the certification proceeding, unquote, and there is absolutely no indication of that whatsoever in the memo, and I'll read a bit of it just to make that point in a second. And here's the overriding issue. Whether people agree or not, this is a legal strategy for constitutionally challenging an election that, by any reasonable measure, had a whole lot of things that would raise the eyebrows at a bare minimum of anybody with half a brain. You stop the vote count in state after state in the wee hours of the morning. You send the poll watchers out of the room so that you can do whatever it is you intend to do without prying eyes watching. And then when the votes finally come in, shazam, they've all changed. Well, they've all gone in a whole different direction. And miracle of miracles, the guy who never got out of his basement suddenly won 90% of all those that hadn't been counted yet or more. Wow, who could have thought it? Answer, nobody. And that's at least part of the reason why anybody paying attention would say, this stinks to high heaven. But hey, that's not what's even being discussed here. Instead, in post-constitutional America, it's suddenly a crime to even suggest that what stinks to high heaven isn't the Biden-Führer's poopy diapers or the bribes that he took from the communists that then rigged the election. It's the fraud that put him there. Back to the Daily Mail version of the propaganda here. The existence of the Cheesebro memo was first revealed in last week's indictment, but its contents were not made public. Perhaps, folks, because they were marked privileged and confidential, and back when we had a rule of law, they would have remained so. But if I was the defense attorney, I might very well have made them public at this point anyway, because they tend to prove that the entire circus here is just that, and bogus to the core. Quote, the memo lays out Cheesebro's plan to have a group of pro-Trump electors, in other words, those that were pre-selected, just like every presidential candidate for both parties has for decades, and assemble on December 14, 2020, in the 6 contested states and produce fake votes, unquote, and that is a bald-faced lie. They would produce exactly the votes that they were supposed to produce, and that, in fact, the state constitutions and state laws of those various states said that they should produce, and therein lies the rub. Trump's legal strategist advised that this was a viable way to ensure, quote, Joe Biden's win was not approved on January 6th. And I'm going to pause right there and say it's not a win, folks. It was a theft. It was fraud, and everybody knows it. Well, at least enough people know it to recognize that there was something that should have been adjudicated in a court of law here. Why, who knows? Maybe even the constitutional procedure. And you got to ask, what was the reason for putting that in the document to begin with, if not for a situation exactly like this? Might have been followed. And that's why there should be a constitutional crisis, because what we had was a coup, not an election. At least the Daily Mail does admit this. The point was to turn attention to claims of, quote, Democrat voter fraud, giving Trump's lawyers time enough to emerge victorious from various legal battles, which were already in progress in all of those contested states. And at least the Daily Mail does quote this from what the lawyer wrote. It seems feasible that the vote count can be conducted so that at no point will Trump be behind in the electoral vote count unless and until Biden can obtain a favorable decision from the Supreme Court upholding the Electoral Count Act as constitutional or otherwise recognizing the power of Congress and not the President of the Senate to count the votes, unquote, the lawyer wrote. Now, at this point, folks, what I think is reasonable to do, and at least I'll give the Daily Mail credit for this, they did include the actual memorandum in here, in toto, is tell you from his own words what one of Trump's legal strategists actually wrote. This is, again, a letter from Kenneth Cheesebro, dated December 6, 2020, and it says, quote, this follows up on my November 18 memo, copy here, advocating that unless the president and vice president plan to concede the race, if they fail to reach 270 electoral votes by December 14th, the Trump-Pence electors all should meet in their respective states and cast their votes and send them to Washington so that the votes will be physically present at the joint session of Congress on January 6th. Pause. Nothing whatsoever illegal or especially unconstitutional about doing exactly what those electors are supposed to do. The question is simply, whose votes will be counted? And on what basis in law? Let me put it this way, folks. If state laws were violated and electors were seated in violation of that state's own laws, well, just exactly then, which electors are the fakes? Oh, yeah, and let's not forget this either. And just exactly who was deprived of the franchise in those states? Cheeseborough goes on to say this memo briefly covers 3 points. 1, the importance of all the electors in all 6 contested states voting. 2, messaging about this being a routine measure, in other words, something that is constitutional in a situation like this. And by that I know he means it has, in fact, you can check the records, folks, if you still remember what history is, and you can see for yourself, there have been similar contests in the past of this republic. And 3, logistics. He goes on to say in the first section here that I'd be happy to follow up on the subject with a separate memo if the national legal strategists are interested, but I've mulled over how January might play out, he said, and it seems feasible that the Trump campaign can prevent Biden from amassing 270 electoral votes on January 6th, and listen to this part, folks, because it's key, and force the members of Congress, the media, and the American people to focus on the substantive evidence of illegal election and counting activities. Anybody have any question that that was precisely what they were trying to focus on? Because that was precisely, let's be honest here, finally, that was precisely what was going on in the 6 contested states. I'll contend that there were other states too, but they were stolen fair and square, so they're not even at issue. Provided, he said, 3 things happen. A, all the Trump-Pence electors meet and vote in all 6 contested states and send in these certificates containing their votes. Listen to this, in compliance with federal and state statutes on December 14th. How is compliance with federal and state statutes a crime, much less even remotely illegal? B, there is pending on January 6th in each of the 6 states at least 1 lawsuit in either federal or state court, which might plausibly, if allowed to proceed to completion, and isn't that an interesting point, lead to either Trump winning the state or at least Biden being denied the state. And of course, ideally by then, Trump will have been awarded 1 or more of the states. And part C, on January 6th, in solemn and constitutionally defensible manner. Now, since when is that a crime? Well, I guess we can answer that now, can't we? Consistent, he wrote, with clear indications that this is what the framers of the Constitution intended and expected, and, he said, consistent with precedent from the first 70 years of our nation's history. Wow, that sounds really seditious now, doesn't it? Back to the quote, Vice President Pence, presiding over the joint session, takes the position that it is his constitutional power and duty alone as President of the Senate to both open and count the votes, and that anything in the Electoral Count Act to the contrary is unconstitutional, unquote. In other words, there is nothing illegal with taking, and let me be as clear as I can, folks, there is nothing whatsoever, at least there didn't used to be when we had a rule of law, there is nothing illegal about taking a constitutional and clearly constitutionally defensible position about legal courses of action. And not only that, hey, remember, this was marked privileged and confidential from attorneys advising their client, and the client is free to accept it or reject it. One thing it's not, however, is criminal. You don't have to share your strategy with the enemy. Well, you didn't, again, back when we had a rule of law. And sadly, as we've learned since, Pence can't be trusted anyway, especially when it comes to doing his constitutional duty or actually having a backbone. And on that score, this really is interesting. Trump's attorney writes to another of his attorneys, I'm not necessarily advising this course of action, and the vice president need not make a decision on how to proceed until January 6th. And obviously, there are many factors that will come to bear on how he proceeds, assuming the race has not been conceded before January 6th. And note, folks, it was not. My point here, said the attorney, is that it is important that the alternate slates of electors meet and vote on December 14th if we are to create a scenario under which Biden can be prevented from, well, basically seizing the rigged election. And he didn't put it that way, but I certainly will. Because with the benefit of 2 years of hindsight, it's increasingly undeniable that that's precisely what happened. The rest of the memo, folks, and I suggest that you read it for yourself. Don't take my word for it, and certainly don't take the word of the Daily Mail, New York Times, or WAPO for it. And that's the point here. We need to spend time actually looking at the real law involved if we want to understand how the United States has been overthrown. But basically, this is sound, arguably very constitutional advice from a lawyer to his client. You know, I can't help but wonder at this point if a Biden lawyer, for example, was to advise him on how he and Hunter could get away with taking bribes, committing treason, and selling out the United States to, say, a foreign communist Chinese party government, if that memo was to come to light, would it be privileged or would it be evidence of a crime that we already know because there's been plenty of other evidence has been committed? Well, one thing's for sure, the Biden Fuhrer has nothing to fear from the likes of a Merrick Garland or Jack Smith. All right, one significant element of the strategy here, which the Daily Mail and most of the press isn't going to spend much time on at all, is how the count can be conducted so that Biden would end up being the one to have to seek Supreme Court review when he's either behind at one point or another, say 12-0 in the electoral count, or he says at the latest when he's behind 232-227. And here's the key point. Even if in the end the Supreme Court would likely end up ruling that the power to count the votes, in the sense of resolving controversies concerning them, does not lie with the President of the Senate, but instead lies with Congress, either voting jointly or in separate houses, letting matters play out this way would guarantee that public attention would be riveted on the evidence of electoral abuses by the Democrats. And guess what, folks? That is absolutely, positively the real thing that they do not and will not allow to happen come hell or high water. And I think they're working hard to bring us to hell. Oh, yeah, before we move on, one other interesting element here. Kenneth Cheeseborough wrote that there are two points that ought to be made to support this being a, quote, routine, sensible measure concerning the slates of electors meeting and voting on December 14th. First, our key adversary in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Elections Commission, or WEC, has recognized that there is plenty of time for litigation to play out and no need to rush unduly because the real deadline is January 6th. See pages 6 to 10 of its Wisconsin Supreme Court brief, and he cites it and links it. And again, folks, don't forget that what the almighty state is claiming the crime here has to do with is fake electors meeting well prior to January 6th to do what they were elected to do by their respective parties. Similarly, he notes, Justice Ginsburg has noted that the date which has, quote, ultimate significance under federal law is the 6th day of January, the date set by 3 United States Code, Section 15, on which the Senate and House determine, quote, the validity of electoral votes. And it cites Bush v. Gore there. And then he quotes Professor Lawrence Tribe, key Biden supporter and fervent Trump critic, who's likewise noted that the only real deadline for the state's electoral votes to be finalized is, quote, before Congress starts to count the votes on January the 6th. And this next paragraph would actually be funny if it wasn't so hypocritically tragic. He says, consider, too, this essay published by none other than CNN.com by Van Jones and Larry Lessig when they thought Trump might be ahead in the count in Pennsylvania, who want to make it clear that Democrats should do exactly what Jack Smith and the communist insurgents are claiming is a crime when Trump tries to do it. And let me just quote a bit of this to illustrate the point. Here's what should happen, they said, on December 14th, 2020, when the electors are to meet and cast their ballots. On that day, assuming the final count of the popular votes has not yet been certified, both slates of Pennsylvania presidential electors should meet in Hattiesburg, both slates. Well, see, if it's the Republicans that were the real electors and the Democrats who were the fake electors, they're saying send the fakes too. Isn't that interesting? Both slates should cast their votes by ballot. And Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf should await the final resolution of the popular vote before he certifies which slate should represent the state. And so long as that happens before January 6th, nothing should stop it from being counted by Congress. Isn't that amazing? And isn't the hypocrisy so thick you can cut it with a knife? Folks, this is precisely what I mean when I say the rule of law in this country has been dead and buried. And this too should be obvious. This has nothing whatsoever really to do with the last election. They got away with that. They rigged it fair and square, and now they're executing the real victors. Nope, this has to do with making blankety-blanking sure that they can successfully do it all over again and rig the next one coming up. Even if their guy is a criminal, bribe-taking, senile traitor. And everybody knows it. Because, see, the Constitution doesn't matter. The rule of law is dead and buried. Again, stick a fork in it. And really, what more proof do we need? So let me wrap it up this way. Not anything that we haven't talked about before, but hopefully by now people are starting to realize just how far gone the rule of law really is. And the question, of course, is which law are we going to pay attention to? Because obviously, if we no longer have a nation which is based on those self-evident truths that there is a God and that it's His law that matters, You just might be on your own. Know who you serve, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.